show.
You have all made it through the dance. You have all made it.
Coming to you from the X-Access, it's John of All Trades with your host, John X.
Welcome to the John of All Trades podcast, episode 73. Your host, John X. Thanks for joining us. Glad to have you back once again. This week's podcast is for you movie lovers. If you're into film, if you love going to the movies, this is the episode for you. This week's episode gives you an inside look, a behind-the-scenes peek at the movie industry that you might not get anywhere else. What am I talking about? This week's guest is Matthew Jones, and he works in film marketing. More specifically, he cuts together movie trailers, which is just such an awesome job. You watch movie trailers, they're on all the time. You know, you go to the movie theater, you go, oh man, we can't miss the previews, right? We can't miss the previews. You probably don't give much thought to who makes those, right? You just go, oh, the filmmakers make those. Not true. At least not always true. And in this case, I found someone who does this for a living. And it's Matthew Jones. And we sat down. I've been trying to get him on the show for months. Seriously, for months. That's how this goes sometimes. A little inside look into my process. There are times where I email someone or I talk to them on the phone or I Facebook message them or whatever. And I say, hey, do you want to be on the show? And they go, sure. When? I go, are you free this week? And sometimes it'll take like 2 days. And then there are people that I work with and dance with and court, and we sort of circle around each other trying to get our schedules to line up, and it takes months. So literally, it took me like 9-10 months to get Matthew on the show. I don't know why, we just never lined up, but sometimes that's the way it goes. So what he does for a living is, like I said, works in film marketing, and he cuts together movie trailers. Now, what movie trailers are we talking about? And when I say that, sometimes he does full theatrical trailers, and sometimes it'll be like a 30-second or a 15-second ad on TV. And he goes into detail about that on the show. But we're talking real big-time movies here. Movies like The Interview with Seth Rogen and James Franco, and American Hustle, you know, with Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper, or Insidious Chapter 3. These are big, big-time movies. 22 Jump Street. His firm did that one. He works for Group 11 Advertising, based in Los Angeles. He works remotely here in Denver. And if you go to their site, g11advertising.com, and check out their sizzle reel, it's just on their homepage, and it's what they sort of do. And it's a nice overview set to Uptown Funk by Bruno Mars and Mark Ronson. I should probably reverse that. Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars. It's amazing. You go, holy crap, look at the work that these guys do. And that's what Matthew does. So it was so cool to get to talk to him about film and about movies and about stuff that we both love. He is a huge Kubrick fan. So he cites 2001 as one of his favorite movies. A Clockwork Orange is another one. We talked about Tarantino. I am such a huge Tarantino freak. I knew who his editor was for all of his movies, except for the last two, because she tragically died not that long ago. And we talk in a little bit of detail about Sally Menke. So if you are a movie nerd, if you love film, if you have aspirations of working in the film industry in some capacity, we talk about that and we go through Matthew's path to get to where he is. I mean, he started out just cutting movie trailers of movies that already existed because he was interested in doing it. Got trained in film, did some work, did some documentary work, worked in wedding videos, eventually just found his way to LA, got an internship, and then from there he was off and running, man. And it's just such a cool story. And there are so many jobs in the film industry that you don't even think about. And being an editor is, I would argue, one of the more underrated jobs out there. I mean, it takes a particular sensibility. A lot of it, you're sort of alone in an edit bay by yourself. I mean, it strikes me as kind of lonely. I have limited experience doing this, but I do cut together this podcast every week. And that can be sort of a lonely pursuit on its own. I'm just cutting together a conversation, but you'd be surprised at how long it can take. But these guys are really helping shape how the movie looks, how it feels. If you think about what is your next scene going to be, that's up to an editor, you know, working with a director and working with a creative team. But the editor is in there assembling the movie. That's amazing to me. That's just so cool. That's where the rubber meets the road. And that's why I adore this episode of the podcast so much. And I'm just pleased as punch to bring it to you. There's a ton in here. We talk about a ton of different projects he's worked on. you know, movies we both like. We talk about how porn is actually kind of an entry point for people to get into film sometimes, because if you think about a porn set, there's people who need to do technical work on that in addition to the two people doing it on screen, right? I mean, that is legit. And he says he shares a story about some people he knows who actually did some work in the adult industry. And we talk about some of the pitfalls of that. It's pretty amusing. You know what? Just a couple of quick plugs before we get going. I heard from a few of you about how there's only like 30 or so episodes available in iTunes, like the most 30 recent episodes of this show. And so I'm working on a fix for that. I will get you updated next week, provided I have an update about potentially getting every episode available in the iTunes store. So feel free to subscribe. You can get them all downloaded. Then you don't even have to worry about it. They'll just come directly to your listening device. Also on Stitcher. Stitcher is on-demand radio. So go listen to us there. Those are two great platforms where you can enjoy John of All Trades. And then every episode is always and forever at johnofalltrades.us. That's J-O-N of all trades.us. Check out the tabs on the top of the site. There's one called Podcast Episodes. It's got all 73 episodes right there for your listening pleasure. So go back, peruse the archive, see if there's something that you're into. But before you do that, listen to this week's episode. It's Matthew Jones. It's episode 73 of the podcast. He is in movie marketing. He's a film editor. He cuts together movie trailers, and his episode starts right now.
Oh, a scratch track is usually when they will have an editor. Before we go to a VO artist, we need this line of copy in the trailer. And rather than go to a VO guy when in the early stages, they're like, we don't know what it's going to be. Just like scratch something out. So you just basically go, you put on your editor or your VO voice and you go, in a world, you know, and right. you lay it down yourself. So it's super embarrassing because we are not voice artists, but every editor has to be comfortable saying something.
Right. One man.
One man.
One way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
In a world.
So it's like placeholder type stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's literally just placeholder stuff. In fact, I had to do it on Saturday for a spot. I had to do a spot for Insidious Chapter 3, a horror film. And the filmmakers weren't happy with something in the spot. They wanted to explain that it was a prequel, and they went back to the beginning. So I had to scratch and Insidious goes back to the beginning. But and then I listened to myself do it and I'm like, this is terrible. So I actually had enough stuff from one of our VO guys. So we call it Frankensteining when you put the words together. I literally cut and pasted Insidious goes back to the beginning from lines he'd already said in other takes.
Is that weird though? Because sometimes you'll get like the wrong inflection, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And people can tell.
Yeah.
Because you're like, Insidious goes back to the beginning. And you're like, that's terrible.
It's like movie phone.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It still sounds better than my voice doing it, though.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny, man.
But this one actually worked, so.
And is it in there, then?
It's in there. It went to the filmmaker, on Saturday. Wow. And hopefully it fools them. And we may have the real guy do it, because they're amazing. I mean, those VO guys are totally it's so impressive.
Oh, totally. Have you ever seen the movie I Know That Voice? It's a documentary.
No, I haven't.
Are you familiar with it?
No.
Okay. It was put together by John DiMaggio, who is voice of Bender on Futurama.
Oh, okay.
And so it was with all these VO guys and gals, and it's like, I know that voice, but you don't necessarily know the person. You may have never even seen the person, and it's just behind the scenes on like how they do what they do. And it was a fascinating, fascinating documentary.
That's really,
I'd check it
really
out.
Cool. I will check it out. It sounds a little bit like In a World.
Totally.
Yeah, which is not really a documentary. It's more like a kind of a, I mean, it's a narrative story,
right.
But it's based on that world.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one. Is that good?
It is really good, yeah.
Okay.
And she's great. I'm totally spacing her name right now, but she's amazing. The filmmaker behind it.
It's that guy's daughter, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm terrible with
this. This is great journalism, isn't it?
So disrespectful to her film and her, because she's awesome.
You know what? Here's what we'll do. It'll be like we're doing an episode of Girl on Guy with Aisha Tyler, and we'll do the mea
culpa.
She's
really great.
She's tremendous.
I like her a lot.
Incredibly talented, and she's also on Archer, which is...
Dude, Archer's great.
One of the two shows that makes me laugh out loud the hardest.
That's cool. Because for some reason I can't really get into a lot of animated TV shows, but I love animation. But that show and South Park, I'm like, I'm in.
Archer makes me laugh just so freaking hard. And then the other one is Silicon Valley.
That
show is so damn funny.
I need to see
second
season. I saw the first one.
Oh, second season's great, dude.
That's what everyone said.
You'll dig it.
That was ripe material.
But anyway, the point is, I will plug the name of her film.
Oh, sweet. Editing.
And I will make sure we get her name right.
Okay, excellent.
So,
okay.
I'll do that in the intro, and I'll be like, we talk about this, and we both sort of can't remember, but we'll get it right.
Okay.
So sitting here with Matthew Jones.
Hi.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. It's been too long since we got together.
Well, it has been too long, and thanks for having me. This is something really new for me.
Really?
I do not ever talk about this kind of thing with anyone, and it's super interesting.
Why not?
I don't know. I always assume, no one really is that interested, but I don't know. It's fun to sit down and do a formal, sit down with someone.
Yeah,
professional.
Totally. Professional. I like that. You flatter me, sir.
It's true.
It's funny because we met for the first time probably in November or December of last year.
Yeah, almost a year ago, but not quite.
Yeah, down at Lowdown Brewery and Kitchen because our wives knew each other.
Yeah.
And it's funny, at the end of that night, you're kind of similar to me. You're like, oh, I got to go meet new people. I don't necessarily want to go out. And we had an awesome time. We hit it off.
Absolutely. It was really fun. And it's always I don't want to sound cynical by saying it's a great surprise to meet great people, but it's you always you just never know. And it could go either way. And But you guys are awesome. So easy to hang out with and just a really, really, really fun night.
Well, it's really fun, too, because our kids, our babies, are 5 days apart, right?
Shockingly close in age.
Because, my daughter is October 27th and your son is 22nd?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so we're definitely going through very similar things.
Right.
Yeah, it was just fun talking to your wife. Just oh, you guys go through that, too? Oh, yeah. Oh, he does that too? We're all you need to communicate with other parents because you instantly feel better because you're we're not the only ones.
Totally. We were at this barbecue last night and we're taping this on Labor Day and it was all parents and I felt really bad for the single people who were there or the people without kids.
I do that too.
Because it's nothing but parents ranging in age from, four down to, a couple months old.
Yeah.
And so we're all talking about the same stuff. And I remember thinking, wow, we all used to hang out in our 20s back when we were all cool.
Oh man. We think this all the time.
Yeah.
And how life has changed. We were the other night, we were hanging out with some parents of a 2 and 3 year old and we ended up talking about something so unsexy. And it was right. We were talking about supplements we take before we go to bed and comparing them. And we were oh man, 10 years ago, we were not discussing this. In fact, we were doing something very different.
Dude, I have an article on my blog about how much I love Metamucil.
Oh man, let's get into that.
Yeah. let's turn this into the Musecast.
Talk about that.
No, Metamucil is the greatest. Okay. I love it. I would shill for it unapologetically if they gave me some money. They should sponsor the show.
I think they should.
Yeah, that would be outstanding. But
brought to you by Metamucil.
Joan of all trades, brought to you by Metamucil. Stay regular.
Stay regular.
Stay regular, kids. So that's not why we're here to talk, though.
Okay.
You are a professional. How do I even describe what you do?
Well, it's a good question because I found myself trying to figure that out when people ask, so what do you do?
Right.
And
kind of the central question of this podcast.
Right. Yeah. And it's been kind of interesting because at first, when I first started getting, doing what I do, which is, well, let me get to that.
Yeah.
I mean, right. This is all how do you describe what you
don't
do?
Don't step on the punchline.
Yeah. I know. I need to be very careful. People would look at me I would say what I do and people would be so what is that exactly? They were really confused. And so I kind of had to work on okay, this is what I do. So I'm an editor and then you kind of have to specify, a newspaper editor or magazine editor.
Right.
And it's well, no, it's a little, it's actually a video editor. Oh, you make wedding videos and stuff. No, not exactly. And some editors do. I've made my share of wedding videos for sure.
No, that is a description of what an editor does.
Absolutely. And so, but people always want to know specifics. And so I was oh, okay. They're actually do want to know, you can't just throw a word out there. And then I say, well, a lot of what I do is film marketing. So I sell, and then I say, I make movie trailers.
Yeah.
Or I make commercials on TV for movies. And people go, oh.
Yeah.
Totally. I know what you're talking about now. Now I find myself saying I'm in film marketing. I make movie trailers.
Yeah.
It just kind of rolls off the tongue.
How long have you done that?
So editing, video, film editing, I've done for about 22 years.
Okay, wow.
I kind of discovered it in high school as a senior, and by no means like in a professional manner at all, but I discovered that I was in theater in high school, and I quickly discovered that as much as I love goofing around on stage,
right,
I really wasn't an actor, but I liked like...
Did you think you were at some point? Because I did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I did theater in high school too.
Yeah, we talked about this.
Yeah, and so I played Bob in The Outsiders. So I got stabbed at the end of Act 1.
That's great.
So I had this big death scene, but the thing about acting is you need to be totally... like uninhibited.
Yeah.
And so I'm standing up there, all the spotlights are on me, and yeah, I've got my teeth clenched and I'm showing all these rings and I just have to scream.
Yeah.
And it was so hard. I could never get out of my head about it.
But you did it. But you put yourself in that position, says a lot.
I felt like it wasn't everything that it could be.
Though. I hear you.
You know what I mean?
You. Well, you kind of like have a sneaking suspicion. You're like, maybe this isn't what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah. Like are my friends out in the audience like making fun of me?
Right.
If you're truly an actor, you just put that out of your head and you absolutely commit to the moment.
Absolutely.
And I had a hard time with that.
Oh, man, I was the same way.
Yeah.
Totally the same way.
It was more of a LARF.
Yeah, it was. And I felt like I gave myself kind of permission in that specific situation where, like, I know what line I need to say. I'm on a stage. I give myself permission to kind of go out there and do this. But, yeah, it always felt a little bit like not completely natural up there.
Right.
So I discovered, I'm like, okay, well... We started making movies, like really bad, terrible action movies senior year.
Awesome.
And just awesome. It's a good word for them. And it'd be like, you know, it'd be like the James Bond kind of action movie, but then it'd always be like some kind of supernatural element for some reason, just so we could work in like that effect of like, I'm in a tight spot. The villain's about to get me. Let me press my watch and I'll disappear, you know?
Right.
You can have someone freeze and stop the camera and start recording again, and they're not there. And you're like, you've instantly created the best visual effect anyone's ever seen.
Oh, dude, that's
someone vanishing in thin air.
That's so funny. My friend Jason had a film, like he made films, like he made skate videos and stuff at the end of high school, and they would do some narrative stuff. And that I remember that effect. And when you're watching it, you're right. It's really not that hard, but it looks amazing.
It's magic. It's like Star Trek Transporter.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, without the, you know, cool special effects, but the idea is crazy and so cool. And you figure that out and you're like, everyone's mind's going to be blown. we made a bunch of those and they just went on and on. And then in college, I was just like, I want to go to film school, but I had a serious girlfriend and she was a writer and she was an actress. And so we formed this little film collective of our friends and actors and writers and camera people, and I tried to do it all because I'm a big fan of Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
And back then I thought, well, man, Kubrick does it all. Why I can too.
Totally.
And you have that attitude where you're like, you've got to be an auteur and you've got to like, you know, do it all. Like Tarantino does it all.
This is my vision.
Yeah. And I need complete ownership over everything.
Right.
And you realize that, yeah, well, that's not good because you need talented people in each area to do amazing things. You need to let go. But I kind of realized in the same way of realized I'm not an actor. I was like, maybe I wasn't getting a whole lot of good feedback on the directing. Like, your films are really good. You have a great vision.
Right.
But I did discover that I loved getting all the footage back and playing with it. Back then it was on, you know, two VCRs.
Yeah.
Deck to deck. And I had a Super 8 camera and a 16mm camera that I rented. And you can splice film. And we're like splicing and gluing and taping film together.
Oh, you're doing it manually, like with the X-Acto knife?
Yeah, I was like, this is what I have to do to learn.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, I didn't want to do it. It wasn't because I was like, this is the only way to cut film.
Yeah.
It was like, I wanted
and
to.
And it's so fun.
Yeah, well, yeah, so amazing. It takes forever. But I did learn some, because I decided to teach myself. I'm like, no, I'm going to, in that auteur way, I'm like, I'm not going to go to film school. I'm going to learn. I'm going to teach myself. And so, you know, two VCRs or splicing the film together, and you're like, you did learn, we can, you know, kind of get into that later, but I did learn a core kind of discipline of like, you have to choose your next shot very, very carefully.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to go back and untape it and cut it.
Oh, you know, funny.
And that's what, you know, a lot of editors say is decades ago, you kind of learn a core discipline because the technology wasn't there to make it quote unquote easy.
Yeah.
So,
you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of watching my mom type, because she learned to type on a typewriter. And so she's very deliberate and doesn't make like any mistakes.
That's a good analogy. Totally.
And so now, I mean, I type really fast, but just loads and loads of errors.
Right.
And so, you know, you just, you backspace it out and you just, that's how you type.
Yeah.
But I watch her and it's like, it's almost slower, but it's kind of like the tortoise and the hare.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
she's very sort of disciplined and I go, wow, look at this.
Yeah.
Just no and like perfect form and stuff. Yeah,
it is. I think it's like really good discipline.
Yeah.
And that comes from like hardship, I guess, in a way. You know?
From an analog world, basically.
An analog world, totally.
Yeah. I mean, with digital, just almost like a wave of your hand.
Exactly.
Wave your magic wand and
exactly.
It's gone.
It's really true. And then, but, you know, and we call that, you know, nonlinear editing is when it's destructive editing. You're meant to destroy and recreate and then destroy and recreate. That comes with its own set of challenges, too.
Yeah.
But it is a different discipline. So anyway, I'm going way off topic, but that's how I got into it, is I discovered that I just love that process of editing images together and putting the music to it and doing the graphics. And then I was like, I realized I was making movies just to do that. So I was like, wait, I should be an editor.
Yeah. This is my thing. So you started this up self-taught, just splicing film on your own, which is sort of mind blowing to me, but how long until, because at the start of this podcast, you talked about cutting the trailer for Insidious, which big time movie. How many steps were in the journey between like, hey, you know, I should be an editor, I like doing this,
right,
to the point where like that's your living and you're making it the core of what you do?
Yeah, well, and I should say, just in all full disclosure, this was for a TV spot for Insidious. I did not cut the original trailer for
okay.
Insidious Chapter 3.
Fair
no,
enough.
No, just so. And this actually is because we do a lot of, and there is a difference between doing like a 15-second or 30-second TV spot or doing a 2.5-minute trailer, which we can totally
okay,
get
yeah,
into.
Cool.
Yeah, but man, you know, I when I realized I wanted to edit, I wanted to make films. I wanted to be a filmmaker. So I realized I wasn't really going to be a director. And everyone's like, okay, so, you know, one day you'll direct, you know, you edit and you work your way up and you'll be a director.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I want to be a really great editor. That's what I want to do. So having that early on in college, I just kind of kept going, and it was just a labor of love for a while and just kept making independent movies. And then, you know, one day I just ventured out to other people and was like, hey, do you need an editor for something?
Yeah.
You know? So I started doing music videos for friends. And then I think the first like paid gig I got was doing, you know, cutting like a fashion show for a friend who did event stuff.
Nice.
And he had a full camera crew and it was super beautifully professionally shot. And I was like, whoa, like real footage that I didn't crappily shoot myself. This is so great. Or, you know, and for years I was doing like, I would take movies. Like I did The Piano and the Jack Nicholson movie Wolf and Pulp Fiction from like mid-90s. And I would record them down to VHS and I would make my own trailer.
Oh.
And that's what I was doing when I got my first gig. And I was
just
like
for fun?
Just for fun. Just to teach myself.
Just like making your own trailer?
Yeah.
For like a real movie?
Yeah, just for myself. Yeah.
Wow.
For a real movie that already had a successful marketing campaign and already had good trailers. And it wasn't that I was trying to do it better. I was trying to do something different.
Yeah.
And, oh man, I look back at those now and I'm like, you had no clue what goes into doing this. It's like, it's not just putting some images to music. It's a totally, has its own kind of language and you got to learn it.
There's like a whole YouTube subculture of people who do that now though.
Yes, there is.
Like,
fan trailers.
Yeah. One of my favorite ones was, Brokeback to the Future. Have you seen that one?
Some of those are great. I have not seen that one.
Okay. Brokeback to the Future is really funny because it reimagines Back to the Future as a love story between Doc and Marty.
That's awesome.
And yeah, or like when
I can see that
when like or like Shining recut as a family comedy.
That is one of the best ones.
That
I
one's great.
Love that one.
Yeah.
Shining.
Shining. Yeah.
And
no,
it works too.
Yeah, it really
works.
Does.
Yeah, in the creepiest way possible.
No,
those are super imaginative, and some of those people cutting those are absolutely trailer editors in their own right.
Yeah, no, totally. It's so funny hearing you say, like, I should be an editor. And I was thinking about it. And I actually do have a favorite editor.
Oh.
And it's Sally Menke.
Oh, yeah.
Who, I mean.
Yeah.
As someone who is.
I'm, like, blushing right now.
Who's like, a huge. I mean, I'm a huge Tarantino
yeah.
geek.
Yeah.
And so when I found out she died, one of the most interesting things for me going into Django was I'm like, ooh, like, and I found myself watching the movie going, I wonder how she would have edited this differently.
Yeah.
Because like she and Tarantino just seem to work together. And I think Scorsese has the same editor that he works with.
Thelma Schoonmaker.
Yeah.
Long time, amazing director. And they, and that's, you know, and it's interesting because a lot of directors say, you know, they love working with women editors because they have a kind of a, I don't want to say like maternal instinct, but a motherly effect on the film.
Right. Just sort of a different sensibility.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they, and it's not about, and again, this is a broad generalization. This is just what directors say is it's not about their ego. They're able to say, look, let's baby this, let's birth this thing together.
Yeah.
And they're able to say, you know, they're going to bring a sensibility to it that is nurturing, I think, in a way that not a lot of other people can, but it's a broad generalization, but it's, I think you need to, as an editor, remove your needs and your point of view sometimes from the process, because it really needs to be about presenting the director with a clear avenue to getting the story told. And that goes for, you know, a movie trailer too. Is like one of my mentors is always says, like, you get a first cut. You, as an editor, you get your first cut, and that's yours.
Yeah.
And you will forever own that.
Yeah.
And so when you put a trailer or a TV spot or even a rough cut of a feature film, that's your cut. You get your editor's cut. And it's what you would do. It's what you think the director will like. It's what you think serves the story well. And then you let it go.
Yeah.
And everything after that is the producer's cut, the director's cut, the marketing's cut.
Wow.
Whoever your client is. And you're a little bit of it, of your cut may remain, but, you know, it's, and you let it go. And the people who I think really succeed are able to do that.
Yeah.
It's definitely something I always struggle with, because you're like, but you don't see what I'm going for. But it doesn't matter. It's like you let it go and you put your best foot forward and then you trust the process. And that's, when you have to have that relationship with the director on a project, you have to get to know them as a person first, almost as a friend. And another one of my mentors in LA said, like, just treat your client like a friend.
Yeah.
Genuinely as a friend. And then you have this great. So going back to your Tarantino point, like, I actually met Sally Menke.
No kidding.
A year before she died.
Wow.
And it was, she wouldn't remember me. It was a, you know, shake her hand at she was speaking.
Yeah.
And man, I was just like so enthralled with everything she had to say. It was just like, you're, and she showed the opening shot of like Kill Bill and she talked about it. And,
right.
Some scenes from Pulp Fiction, and man, just the most delicate personality. Like she's just so like, so lovely to sit and listen to. And I find a lot of editors are fascinating to hear talk about their films.
Well, yeah, you talked about the editor's cut.
Right.
Which it was something that was really compelling to me because, you have this footage. You have all the raw material, and you get to assemble it in the way that you see fit. And, there's always going to be some pride of authorship that you have to let go. Mm-hmm. I do that a lot, because I'm a consultant. Mm. And so I end up generating a lot of raw material for my clients.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, okay, you know, this is how I see your brand, and this is how I see what you want to do, and this is how I've assembled it. And people go, no, but and your inclination is to go, no, but like what you're trying to go for, is,
and your heart's in the right place.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and I mean, you should advocate for what you do, because you may help them recontextualize their own work.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to just roll over.
No, you don't.
But you can't hang on too tight.
Right.
Which is such a weird thing.
Yeah.
To go through when Sally Menke, when you were listening to her, did she talk about like the choices she made, like with certain,
and
when she showed like
footage?
And
again, going back to that ego, the lack of ego was just absurd, because you're like, are you kidding me? You've made some of the greatest films of all time. I mean, you know, created them literally, like edited them.
Yeah.
But the lack, she was just like this light, there was this air of lightness to her. But you knew her brain was just, you know, so, and she was very much like, what we were going for here was this. And we just thought, oh, that's a nice moment. Oh, this could, you know, and it's like, it is so interesting, because you're like, oh, wow. So, okay.
That's like so understated.
That's so understated. But that's kind of, I think the magic of her was like, she trusted, I think they trust each other, right? She obviously, he trusts her to put the best stuff up on screen, and And she did. But yeah, it was, I was looking for this, like, you know, this, like, explain why Vincent did that at that moment. And that was, you know, and it was such, so light and easy. And it was just like, these moments just kind of happen. And then you kind of learn from that. You're like, wow, it's organic. And I think some of the best editing relationships with directors are, they're just like natural. I know that my favorite directors I've worked with on a much, much, much tinier scale than what we're talking about. Man, when you have that symbiotic relationship with a director, it's like you guys are just working together, going down a path, and your editor's job is to kind of present like alternate ideas, like what you said with contracting. It's just like, well, I'm advocating for this idea, you're putting it out as an option, and that's what the director needs, because directors are way close to their subject.
They
need someone to step back and say, what about this?
Totally. I was doing the 48-hour film project one time, and I was writing. And have you ever done that?
No, but I have friends who...
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, I hear it's intense.
It's super intense. My my friends did it again this year, and they said it was the easiest it's ever gone, because it was like their fifth year doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
they're professionals now.
And totally. But I was writing, and I wrote this one character, and he was like this mafia boss. And I didn't realize while writing it, but the actor was like reading his lines and rehearsing, and he goes, I'm kind of getting a used car salesman vibe from this guy. Like, very sort of oily, very slick, trying to, like, sell a bill of goods to this character. And I go, you know, I didn't write it that way, but that's better.
Right.
Like, do that.
Right.
Like, play that up. It's much, it's, you know, rather than the stern-faced sort of, you know, like, authoritarian boss. I'm like, no, this guy, to his core, is sort of an oily douchebag.
Mm-hmm.
Play that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's exactly what you're describing.
It's great. Like, that is truly the art of collaboration, where you have someone else can say, I love that idea, but, like, let's take it to this level, maybe. And you're, like, free enough and open enough to go, yeah, I love that idea. Let's do that. Yeah.
Did you always know... I mean, you said one of your first paying gig was editing together this fashion show.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Did you always know you wanted to do trailers?
No. And no, not at all. I really thought, I'm seeing myself as maybe doing a TV show, like maybe cutting a TV show. And it came from, like, I just knew I loved movies. I mean, I loved, you know, always loved movies, like, you know, a lot of people do.
What's near the top of your list movie-wise? I'm not going to ask favorite, because that question sucks. But
yeah, it's tough to say a favorite. Man, I'd have to say I can do a top five of, like,
yeah,
you know, I mean, it's hard not to put just five Kubrick films in there. but I would say Clockwork Orange is in there.
Yeah.
Heat, Michael Mann's Heat is definitely in there. I love Sally Potter's Orlando, which is a little kind of a little more obscure. But
yeah, I've never seen that.
Oh, my gosh. It's kind of been up in conversation in social media recently this week, because there's a lot of exploration of women in film, women directors specifically in film and social media right now. Because there's been some comments made by other filmmakers about why female directors aren't doing bigger films, and a lot of people are saying things maybe they didn't mean, and just maybe analyzing kind of, you know, maybe the wrong thing. But there's just a lot of exploration of, like, these amazing films that from female directors. And Orlando is just a masterpiece.
When was that made?
92, I want to say. And it's, man, I could totally get into that film, but I'd look it up. That's all I have to say.
Totally.
Look it up. It's magical. Man, I'd probably throw 2001 in there.
Yeah.
Another Kubrick movie. and then I'd have to throw David Fincher in there, because he's just the greatest director alive right now.
Yeah, he's something else.
Yeah, I'd have to say Fight Club, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fight Club's awesome. Yeah, my list is like Wizard of Oz.
Oh, that's great.
Pulp Fiction. Shawshank. Just Darabont has such a deft touch in that movie.
It's a crazy, crazy good movie.
And then it's funny, because I'd put Swingers in there.
I love Swingers.
Mostly because of how it sort of makes me feel.
Yeah.
And like... You see these guys, like, sort of on the upswing,
yeah,
and, like, it all really comes together for them. And that movie is just, it's so funny and so...
I find it's like an old friend. You just kind of sit down with that movie,
totally,
and you're just like, I just want to hang out and, like, watch them play hockey, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's my favorite movies.
That seems funny.
Favorite movies. I just love that movie. It's just a world you just love to spend time
in. I do, too. Okay, so you knew you loved film.
Yeah.
And you thought maybe you were going to work on a TV show, but... Take us back to...
Yeah, I think it came from... I went and got training up in Portland at a film center that specialize in Avid training, which is, you know, software that people edit on. Avid Media Composer, Avid Film Composer it was called back then.
I learned on Final Cut Pro.
Yeah, a lot of people did. I also, I used Final Cut Pro the first week it was out. It was just, you know, back then you couldn't afford an Avid of your own. back in mid to late 90s, it was like $100,000 minimum to get Avid put together.
Holy hell.
So, it, you know, obviously came down in price a lot, but Final Cut Pro came out at, I think it was $1,000 when it came out in 99. And man, I remember my filmmaker friend who now works at Pixar. We were like, let's get Max. And, you know, neither of us had, you know, worked in the industry at that point, but we were like, we're going to be filmmakers. And, we got Max, we got like the blue Mac Tower and Final Cut Pro. And we were like, let's figure it out. And we did, we taught ourselves Final Cut Pro. But
really anyway, not that hard either.
It's not. And that was great. I mean, it's Apple, right? It just like they make it super accessible. Yeah. But I was getting some Avid training, and I think a lot of what I wanted to do kind of came from talking to the editors there. It was up in Portland. So we had some editors from LA come up and they worked on TV shows. And they were like, they just kind of told us what they did. And I was like, whoa, a working editor on a TV show. This is how much they make. This is what their lifestyle's like. This is their schedule. And I was like, oh, I could do that.
Yeah,
I
totally.
Could do a TV show. And so my mind was open. I didn't have any idea. I just knew I wanted to cut. And so I did a documentary. Was the first like thing after that. And
what was it about?
Man, it was actually a really fascinating documentary called Rockets Red Glare. It's out there. It was at Sundance, and it is about the world's first heroin addicted baby.
Yikes!
He was born addicted to heroin, and he had a fascinating life. He actually grew up to be. He was at one point Sid and Nancy's bodyguard.
Huh.
He worked. He did stand up. He was this crazy big character. Addicted his whole life and fought with addiction. And then he was addicted to methadone, right?
That
gets you off of that stuff. And struggled with severe obesity and but the sweetest, most interesting, vibrant character, a great documentary subject.
Wow.
Yeah. And so there were a number of celebrities he was friends with, Steve Buscemi and Matt Dillon, and a lot of people were in the movie. And that really helped me. That film really helped me because I was able to say I cut a movie with Matt Dillon and Steve Buscemi, and they were in it. And that counts for a lot because people will say, what have you done?
Yeah.
Well, I've done, and at that time I'd done some wedding videos and they were great. Right. And they are. It's a ton of work, but the industry is very much like, hey, what have you done?
Sure.
With a name I'd recognize.
Yeah.
And a lot of independent movies are like, oh, this, I'm sure it's really good, but no one was in it. And
yeah.
Sad enough to say the industry looks at like, you know, well, give me, and sometimes all you really need to on your resume is one film that has some recognizable names in it, because it means somebody's going to see it.
Yeah.
And somebody financed it with those names in mind, which is going to get an audience. So that was my progression. I went from documentary and then I got a gig cutting an MTV spot for a TV show for MTV. For the person that I cut the fashion video for years before.
Really?
Yeah. Stayed in touch with him.
What show was it?
It was actually, okay, there was an MTV show and a VH1 show. The VH1 show was Tori Spelling's sitcom.
Okay.
I forget the name of it. I think it was called So Tori or something like that.
Right.
And then the other one was Andy Galifianakis.
Andy
Galifianakis?
No. Andy Milonakis.
Andy Milonakis.
It was the Andy Milonakis show?
Yeah, and it wasn't for the show. It was for selling the DVD for season one.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was like, get the Andy show. And it was all his best little moments and putting it all together. And that's where I was learning like advertising.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, for the first time, like,
okay,
this is not just cutting a trailer in your basement.
Andy Milonakis was that kid who, well, that man who was like 30, but he looked like he was like 11.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And it took me a little while to figure that out. I was like, well, this kid's super talented and really young. But he'd been around the block for sure. Like,
yeah.
And it was really, some of it was really clever and some of it was just absolutely bizarre visual stuff. And it was really fun to edit with and
totally
really fun to cut. So that was my progression. It was like documentary filmmaking in my back pocket, kind of like, okay, this is my bread and butter maybe. And so I got more and more things, and I moved to LA. Actually, my intention to go back to London.
Oh, really?
And when I, you know, during this time in the late 90s.
That's where you grew up, right?
That's where I grew up. I was born there, and I grew up there until I was about nine. Okay. So, you know, I'm not completely raised there, but lived a good amount of time there. And then came over here, lost the accent, obviously, and which sucks.
But you just sound like some jerk like the rest
of
us.
I know, it's like Colorado, like, what's that accent?
Yeah. it's saying instead of or.
Right.
So
exactly. I should do the rest of it in an English accent, but I won't put you through that. But I really wanted to go back to London. I wanted to work for the BBC, and I all these British TV shows I just adored. And
yeah,
I was just like, yes, it's going to be great. I'm going to go back. And I talked to someone at the BBC, and they're like, you know, you're going to compete with all these people who have come up through the ranks. They've lived here their whole life, and
yeah.
they've done what they already have an in. They're like, go back, go to New York, go to LA, get some experience in the industry, and then come back one day.
Yeah,
and it was great advice because that's kind of what I did. I went back and I moved. And
one of the few people moving to LA to not be an actor.
Right. Yeah, that's a huge bonus right there.
Right.
Just the one less actor for everyone else to compete with. But in the old day, I could have been, you know. Thank goodness I realized I didn't have the acting chops. Yeah. So I got a documentary gig about a motorcycle great who raced motorcycles.
Nice.
Within a few months of moving there, and that was my first documentary feature in LA, and I went to a premiere and it was awesome, and I was living in LA and I lived in Hollywood right with literally studios right around.
Nice.
Well, there's only one studio in Hollywood.
That's really
what people don't know. There's only one film studio in Hollywood. And it's Paramount. And of course there's little other small ones now.
Well, sure, of
but
course.
Of the original big seven or six or seven, only one is actually in Hollywood.
Where are the rest of them?
Burbank.
Oh, okay.
Culver City.
Yeah, all right. Know,
it's kind of a trick question, but they're all in LA.
Yeah.
But, oh man, I literally, and actually going back, I feel, this is fascinating because I feel so self-indulgent that someone actually wants to listen to me just jabber.
No, please.
But in 93, I actually wrote a spec script for Star Trek The Next Generation.
Nice.
And my aunt, who is a novelist, convinced me to do it. She had tried and failed, and she was a published novelist. She's like, but you love Star Trek. Why don't you do it? And I was like, I'm not really a writer, but I enjoyed writing, like creatively writing. And so I did, and I submitted to an agent. And the agent's like, nah, it's not going to work. And so I submitted it myself, and it got me an invite out to Paramount to pitch stories.
Wow.
And I was so green. And so it was on my 19th birthday. And I was so, so over my head. Like, right? It was just ridiculous.
You didn't know what the hell you were doing.
No, I was starstruck and I had no clue what to do. I wrote the script called The Blood That Moves the Body. And a great title. Maybe not the best script in the world. But it got me in the door. And I remember walking past like Ronald Moore, who went on to do Battlestar Galactica and
right.
a bunch of other great things. And Brandon Braga, who's just like still amazing, amazing writer and producer. And I just saw their names on the doors, and I was so starstruck. I just remember going in and just telling them, whoever I talked to, poor people, they were like listening to my pitches. And Next Generation was just wrapping up at that time, and they were about to do Deep Space Nine. And so they made me pivot and say, hey, can you pitch us some stories for Deep Space Nine? And I was like, I'm just so happy to be here. It's my birthday. I just saw Brandon
Braga's name. It was your birthday?
Yeah, it was my birthday that day. So it was on my 19th birthday.
Wow.
And so they were like, all right, kid, you know, good script. We can't buy it because Next Generation's, we've committed to their script. This is the final year. But at that point, it gave me a little bit of confidence to be like, okay, I may have some writing chops, and editing in a way is writing.
Yeah.
Back. So yeah, sometimes you write copy, sometimes you write scripts, and sometimes you just write visually with, you know, they say it's, everyone's heard this, but you write a film three times. It's like, you know, when the screenwriter writes it, the director films it, and then the editor edits it.
Yeah.
And so it goes through three big rewrites. So I don't know. I felt like I had a little bit of that in my back pocket to help me as an editor. And so it just went from there. And man, I just met a really, really, really great editor. I started as an intern at a studio in LA. I helped them build out this just new, brand new HD studio. It's like high definition was the new term, 2004. And man, it was this big $1 million studio, and they put all this equipment in it, and I helped them build it for free. I was an intern, started at the bottom. I just wanted my foot in the door, and I got to sit with this amazing editor and watch him work. He let me pull some stuff from like a feature film. I think it was Hostel. that horror film.
The Eli Roth film?
Yeah.
Wow.
And he was pulling, this was like 2005 at this point, and he said, I'm doing an airline version of this, so we need to like...
Who wants to watch that on a plane?
Right? So yeah, it's like slightly...
what the hell?
Less comforting than an actual like plane disaster movie. You don't want to watch that on a plane. You don't want to watch Hostel on a plane either. But somebody somewhere saw an airline version of that movie. So it was, he was coloring the blood darker.
Uh-huh.
And taking out the really bad parts. And I was scarred. I was just like scarred, yeah, because he didn't have the soundtrack for it. He was just doing the video portion.
Oh my God.
So I had this feature film, no sound, just the video. No context. I didn't know what was happening. I knew everyone on screen was in a lot of pain. And I was kind of scarred, but there was like, I'll never forget that. He had me pulling selects, which is what we call, moments of the film that suit your purpose. And yeah. And I worked with him for about a year and a half, and I got to cut a spot finish a spot. I did onlining, which is color correcting, up-resing and finishing, really, really literally finishing it for broadcast, a spot for Talladega Nights.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's all I needed to get into an agency. A marketing agency was the one thing, because the guy who hired me, who's now another huge mentor of mine and my boss technically, looked at it and said, hey, I know you understand how to sell movies. And thank goodness he saw that, because that got me in, and that's, I've been working with that agency for 8.5 years now.
Wow.
So
that is awesome. I want to get your opinion about a couple of things that I thought of while you were talking. Hmm. One is, you mentioned wedding videos as a weigh-in, going way back.
Yeah.
And, just getting experience cutting these things and learning how to sell.
Yeah.
One thing I've read about is... the porn industry is really big in LA.
Yeah, and yeah, in the Valley. Yeah.
And in the Valley, sure.
No, I'm just kidding. It's all over LA.
But I've heard that porn is actually a training ground for a lot of people who work on the technical side of movies.
Yeah.
Like, here's how you hold a boom mic.
Sure.
Here's what it's like to be on a movie set. Granted, people are fucking each other. But, and so kind of a very particular type of movie.
Yes.
But
still filmmaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There still needs to be someone who, does audio.
Yeah.
And, edits the thing together.
Mm-hmm.
Have you come across that where people sort of got chops doing that?
Yeah.
Or is that more of a myth?
No, it's absolutely true. Totally true. In fact, one of someone, and I say the word mentor because I really did have, two or three really, really experienced guys who had been doing this for a long time in LA and had seen a lot of different sides of the industry. And one of them worked for Playboy.
Yeah.
And another one had... started out, cutting porn because it was good money.
Sure.
And it was a lot of work.
Yeah.
And, it's hard work to do that. And also there was a lot of work to do. So it was just like, hey, and I would come across job, entries for that, like job listings for like adult film, and the money was good. And they said, look, I'll warn you about two things. One, you don't want to get shoehorned into doing just that.
Sure.
And the number two thing is you don't want to stop at liking sex.
Yeah.
Because when you look at that all the time, you don't want to see a naked woman for a long time.
Right.
After you work on that. And you don't want to become desensitized to that. No. You want to enjoy that. You want to keep it fresh. And I love
you
that.
You don't want to remove the novelty of that.
Exactly. You don't want to you don't want to become like, oh God, another beautiful woman. God,
jeez,
it's over it.
Brutal.
So over it.
Another day at the office.
Yeah, exactly. And besides the fact, I have heard from people who've worked on those sets, it's like, hey, porn is that scene you may have seen. That was 3 hours. Okay.
Yeah.
And it was, everyone was miserable that day. And it was just like, it's not as glamorous, quote unquote,
right,
as it looks.
No,
or
well,
easy.
Nothing ever is.
Yeah, it's true.
I think about, I have very limited experience editing. I took a class in college where we had to make a silent video.
Yeah.
And we had to make a music video.
Yeah.
And for the silent movie, there's not even any sound in it. But it was like 5 minutes and it took us probably 30 hours.
Right.
To cut together.
Right. Right.
Took forever.
Yeah.
Like log and capturing and, in point and out point.
It's kind of eye opening how, what goes on behind that.
And it's like, do we do a fade out, fade in here, or do we dissolve to the next scene? Like, like what transition do we choose?
Totally.
So two things. First, I had an action sports filmmaker on here not that long ago, and he said that audio is far more important than visual, because he said, how did he say it? Sound without picture is radio, but picture without sound is just surveillance footage.
That's good. I haven't heard that, but that's so, it's very true, I think.
And that's related to sort of the question that I'm asking in this very roundabout way, but to do what you do, it's basically frequently you alone just with footage and audio and cutting it together, right? Mm-hmm. Does that ever get lonely? And is there truth in what he said with regard to audio and video? I'm muddling two questions here.
No, that's great. To handle the second one first, it's the same idea of, and it's really elegant way to put it. I'm gonna steal that in the future, but
that's perfect. I stole it
on a much, much simpler basis. It's just like if you look at a screen and it's dark, and it's like, you know, if you're watching a movie and you got two characters in the woods and it's like twilight and you can just barely see them, but you can hear what they're saying perfectly, you'll watch that scene for an hour.
Yeah.
But if you are looking at the beautiful sunlit, those two people out in a meadow and it's beautiful and you can't quite hear what they're saying, 30 seconds and you're like, I'm out. Right. That's in the simplest form. That's it. That's why sound is so much more important.
Well, and he said you may have one or two layers of video.
Yeah.
But typically like seven or eight.
Oh, absolutely.
Like audio tracks.
Absolutely. You know, and if you're, we call, you know, if you're looking at your timeline on your screen and you have, I mean, you really do. You have like one or two layers of video. I mean, why would you really only need one layer of video for the most part? And maybe you'll throw a graphic on top,
yeah,
or some kind of special effect, but then you'll have 8 to 16 layers of sound effects, music,
yeah,
dialogue, ambient noise, yeah, all that stuff. So yeah, every timeline you look at is always bottom heavy.
Wow.
And then the first question.
So with what you do, you know, you say, I make movie trailers, and people go, that sounds awesome, right? But the process itself, is it difficult? Is it tough? Or do you really enjoy that? Because I know when...
Oh, does it get lonely?
Yeah, when you listen to stand-ups talk, mm-hmm, you know, a lot of times I'll be working out new material in front of like 6 drunks, you know, at an open night,
right,
or open mic. And that's not fun, but you sort of have to love the process.
Totally.
And so much of what everyone does, I found doing this podcast, is basically ditch digging.
Yeah.
Where, you know, maybe you have this whole, you know, block of footage that you just have to input.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, what is a process like for you when you're cutting something together?
That's a really good question. And it doesn't get lonely for me because I don't want to speak too broadly for every editor, but I think every editor is okay with sitting alone in a room,
right,
with their stuff and just kind of doing it.
It's kind of like me with this podcast. I'll, you know, I edit it and I clean it up.
Yeah, I was going to say, you do have experience editing because that's what you do.
And there are times where, like, just like anything else, it's kind of a slog.
Yeah.
Where you're like, nah, like, yeah. I don't. But, and you look at how much real estate you have yet to cover.
Totally.
Like, oh, it's going to be a lot. And
yeah,
it's going to be a long edit for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But
I think I do feel that, you know, and there are times, like, you know, a couple of editors I've worked with have said, you know, sometimes you get a project where you're like, it just flows and it's, I don't want to say easy, but it's easier.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I mean, honestly, I'd say of all the different kind of things in the marketing realm, we have commercials, we'll do 30-second commercials and 15-second commercials. And then anything above that gets towards a teaser or a trailer in length. But honestly, putting together a 2.5-minute, it's a typical length for a trailer for a film when you're starting with nothing is incredibly daunting.
Yeah.
And so it can be a little bit like, just get something. It's like a writer, you know, just get that first page written,
right?
Just get something down.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be good. Just get it done.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what they say, like, get that first draft as a writer. It's like, just scribble it down. It doesn't have to be perfect. Do not go back and read the page you just wrote. Like, just get it done and then finish the end and then go, oh, Lord. Okay. Now I got some work to do. But it's less work than what you did first.
So yeah, generating the raw material is so much harder.
Totally. And I think that's true in every field. So, yeah. I mean, honestly, the some of the best talents I've learned is to script everything out.
Okay.
First, you really, really need to write a script first. And that's, you know, the head of the agency I work for is technically my client, boss client, you know, he's also a really good friend, but he's just an amazing editor and a great writer, like a much better writer than I'll ever be. And he can write copy, a marketing copy. Like, he can just sit in a room of executives right. and be like, this is what you're going to sell your movie. This is what you're going to say to sell your movie. And taglines, like, just taglines, like, come out. But
they just flow out
yeah,
of them.
Yeah. But then as an editor, you watch him work, and he's like, he has this beautiful sensibility about, like, creating, like, putting everything together. And I'm like, wow, he's very inspiring for me. And but he's made me a much better editor just by, I'll put that stuff together and put it in front of him. And he'll say, no, it's not, you know what, go back, try this again, try this. And by having strict standards, I've kind of, it's raised my game up.
Sure.
And to answer your question, he says, you know what, this, like, a movie trailer's tough. It's one of the harder things to do. Sales reels are tough too, when you have to, like, take Sony's movies and say, this is our upcoming slate. Something yeah. we're working on right now. You know, you have to put something together for them. And it's, no one ever is ever going to see it, except a marketing team or a bunch of businessmen from right. Japan. That's really hard to do too. And then you get 15 second, you know, little commercials that are incredibly hard to tell a story in 15 seconds, but they might be easier. So yeah, to answer your question, all the time.
Yeah, that's wild to me, because one thing I'm curious about, and if you can expand upon it, you're probably seeing footage from these movies before almost anyone else.
Yeah.
And so what is the process? Like, how does a trailer or a commercial or something like that come together? Like, do you collaborate with the creative team on the movie?
It really does depend on where it comes from, the size of the movie.
Okay.
You know, sometimes, like, we've cut a lot of films for smaller scale, but still, like, big budget movies mm-hmm. that we will get dailies, which is, you know, basically wow. the stuff, the unfinished footage that doesn't look great. It's just the actual takes that they've, you know, processed. And so it's early days, and, you know, it can be months before the film is done. And, you know, we'll work with the marketing team and say, especially if it's someone like Sony or a division, a part of Sony that said, we're marketing this film.
Yeah.
And, 'cause they bought the film. And so we answer to two people, the filmmaker and the studio that's paying for the distribution.
Yeah, right.
And it depends how, you know, sometimes, and again, this isn't just for Sony. This is lots of clients.
Sure.
But they will say, yeah, the filmmaker gets to weigh in on this.
Ah.
And so that makes our job a little trickier, because
sure.
we have to please them. And then you get into, like, you got to please the filmmaker, but also please. And this is anyone with clients, right?
Yeah, oh,
it's
yeah.
Like, who's paying the bill, but also who's the creative client? Like, who's like, it's who's, there's two cooks in this kitchen, so to speak.
Right.
So, you know, yeah, it's a deal. You know, a big part of being an editor is the political part too. And they say, like, technically, and I say this to, like, assistant editors I've had or editors coming up, it's really who you are in that editing bay. The technical stuff is secondary or even tertiary. Like,
yeah.
everyone can learn the technology, but if you can't sit between a producer and a director and kind of, like, act as the diplomat between them,
right,
then you're not doing your job as an editor.
You're right. You're almost like a child of divorce.
Yeah.
Where mom and dad don't necessarily see eye to eye.
Yeah, definitely.
And you're sort of between them.
Definitely. And their egos are 100% there. Like, they're not,
oh, yeah.
to go back to the ego thing, they're not, there's no reason for them to get rid of their egos. They,
no.
They have their intention. This is their baby.
Yeah.
And rightfully so, I get it.
And, you know, what you're describing is having a proper bedside manner.
Absolutely.
So, that's awesome.
That's a great way to put it.
When we first met, you told me you were working on, like, The Interview.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
With Seth Rogen and James Franco.
Yeah.
That one that had all the controversy
exactly,
around it.
Exactly, yeah.
But you told me you were, like, I think you were on a conference call, like, with them, right? Where they were talking about it?
No, I was privy to emails that
oh,
had
I gotcha.
Gone around discussing what to do.
Yeah.
And so I was on a conference call, not with with Seth or Seth Rogen or James Franco, but other producers at Sony.
Right.
There was a phone call. It was like, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
And so it was one of those things where we were exploring, okay, this thing's not going to be in the theaters because the theaters don't want to touch it because
yeah.
they're afraid of getting blown up
right.
by somebody.
Sure.
There's a lot of fear going on, a lot of stuff like that. So, and that was my understanding. This isn't anything that people don't know, but it was like, okay, well, what if it went on demand? What if we just
yeah.
did strictly, like, let's release this thing? Like, you know, and Sony's attitude was, again, this is common knowledge. Like, Sony's like, you know, we're not going to back down from this. Like, let's go out and let's release this film. People want to see it. And a number of theaters, Alamo said they showed it. And, you know, a number of smaller independent theaters were going for it. But yeah, I remember it was like the day before. It's like New Year's Eve, maybe right. The day before New Year's Eve. But they were like, let's do this. And so we kind of had to, we're on vacation and fire everything up and cut some new spots that said, hey, we're being defiant and we're going out there and you can see this thing. And
good.
It was fun to be involved in something like that because it was, I got a note from our client. She was like, you guys were kind of part of something new. Like this had never been done before. A major film being released on demand only first. It's like in the marketing world and film, that's kind of like a new little thing. So that was kind of interesting little
that's cool.
experience to have.
Yeah. You know, so something that just occurred to me, you work remotely.
I mean,
here in Denver.
Yeah. And that's the technology has allowed that.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But do you have the files you must be dealing with must be enormous. Do you have like a server farm in your house?
the drives have gotten a lot bigger and a lot faster. And 4K is the next, like that. Those files are huge.
Yeah. I saw when I talked to the action sports guy, you got to imagine the visual component, you know, they're down in South Africa,
big lenses and huge files.
His stuff was in 4K and he had servers in this one room.
Yeah. You really do. That's where it's coming. And that's why everyone's like, we're going to have to somewhere. I got a lot more hard drive space because those files are huge. And we move stuff. I mean, my agency is in LA and I go out there. I have a bay out there. You know, I have two basic editing bays that are identical in equipment. And so they're mirrored to each other so I can control one remotely from the other place. And a lot of my clients are very like, they're hands off in that, you know, like, I don't need to come sit in the bay with you. You know, we trust you. Do this. It may not be what we're looking for, but we'll just give you some notes. And everything is big files going back and forth over the, and honestly, it wouldn't have been possible 5 years ago. It just wouldn't have been like that recently. It just, the technology is there now and the broadband is there now.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It allows me to, and a lot of editors are doing that now. They've moved out of LA to either Northern California or Portland and, you know,
wherever they want to be
out here. And I'm only 2 hours away by plane. So
that's true.
It beats LA traffic.
Certainly does. So give me a rundown of, because we're going to need to wrap up here soon. But give me a rundown of some of the things that you've done that we may have seen. Feel free to name drop. This is brag on yourself.
American Hustle.
Okay.
Wow. I did a theatrical trailer for that. Super proud of.
Yeah.
That was just won an Addie actually, which is an advertising award. I did a trailer for the documentary on Barack Obama for HBO.
Cool.
Right after he was elected, when everything was happy and everyone was so excited about
the
new direction.
As Sarah Palin might say,
the
Hopi changey stuff.
Right. It was a very Hopi changey.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, big bombastic YouTube songs in it. It was very, very hopeful and very exciting. And, that was a fun trailer to work on. Let's see. Oh my goodness. It's The Amazing Spider-Man.
Nice.
1 and 2. And then going back to Amazing, or no, just Spider-Man. Spider-Man
right.
3, Spider-Man 2.
The Tobey Maguire versus the Andrew Garfield.
Exactly,
ones.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We did all the worldwide marketing campaigns for those. Man, Resident Evil, let's see, the whole Insidious thing.
So how many projects are you typically working on at a time?
When we're busy, 4 or 5
wow.
films at a time. Sometimes as many as 6 or 7.
Yikes.
Which takes a lot of juggling, but typically.
And a lot of different sensibilities.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You have to put on different hats and be like, okay, you know, like these movies didn't come out at the same time, but like doing something like an Insidious versus an Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, definitely. And there's different genres and you know, I have strengths and I have weaknesses.
Sure,
just like everyone else. And I'm not the best comedy cutter.
Huh.
I've been told I can do it, but it's not
Is it
my
your
strength.
Britishness?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
I'm
I don't
kidding.
Know.
I
don't, no, I know it could be. Seriously, I think about like I don't have like I'm not a very funny person, but I have a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
Like I love laughing at really funny things. We were talking about 30 Rock.
Right.
But like you know, I was raised on Monty Python and British comedy, maybe that's it. But it is a timing thing. It is an interesting timing thing. Though I did cut some Seinfeld spots that worked out pretty well.
You know, it's funny because I was watching, who the hell knows, I watch a lot about comedy and like how comedy gets made.
Yeah.
And they say with comedians, you can, there are three prominent things when it comes to comedians. There's talent, there's tenacity, and there's timing.
Right.
And you can always get more tenacious. You can always hustle more. You can always work harder.
Yeah.
You can improve your talent.
Yeah.
Like you can get better, but you can't teach timing.
It's so true.
Timing is just one of those God-given things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's true in editing too, is that you can learn timing, but you also have to have an innate sense of it too.
Yeah.
Like you, like to your point. And comedy is like, it's something I struggle with. Drama, action, going back to your point about different genres and fields.
Sure.
Like drama, action, that kind of stuff is something I'm super comfortable and the documentary kind of feel. So, we were doing Oscar season stuff. It was like Whiplash won. That was one of ours, and Still Alice, Julianne Moore.
Yeah.
And so it was a lot of like heavy stuff, but you have to make it super appealing too. And that can be tricky too. So you have to make it fun to watch. Like you don't want to sell a sad film to someone.
Right.
No one wants to feel that.
No. Unless you're, you know, it's like some weird, like Werner Herzog type.
Yeah. If it's Fitzcarraldo, you can be like, well, let's see. It's going to be fun watching him like move this thing through the forest. It's going to be crazy, but it's going to be fun, even though it's totally tragic and depressing.
Yeah. Or like, you know, like something like Michael Haneke or something.
Tough.
Brutal stuff.
Tough sell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or who's the guy, God, what is his name, who makes the, like Lars von Trier.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Breaking the Waves. And
yeah. And the one where the world's ending.
Oh, Melancholia?
Yeah.
Yeah. Visually stunning.
Oh, yeah.
That would be a blast to work on that because, oh, man. And the marketing for that was beautiful, actually. They really got a lot of people to see
that. It was pretty gorgeous.
It was gorgeous, yeah. Tough movie though.
The other, it's funny you bring up comedy because I remember I saw the first time I saw the trailer for Superbad, I go, no,
right?
Like this looks dumb.
Yeah.
And then I saw the Red Band trailer.
Right.
And I go, holy shit, this looks like the funniest movie ever.
Love that. We did This Is the End.
It's yeah.
Movie, This Is the End. And we did a Red Band for that as well. And man, that's where you can really let loose.
Yeah.
And really show what the film is really about.
Totally.
22 Jump Street, same thing. Like some of the best stuff I can say from 22 Jump Street was cut out of that movie. And
really?
I really enjoyed both those movies.
I did too.
But man, the stuff, this deleted scenes for 22 Jump Street, good Lord, look those up because
you will
just die.
Because I mean, love that movie.
Yeah. It's some filthy, awesome stuff that got cut from that movie.
Well, I mean,
to use it in the marketing stuff.
Yeah.
We get to use it. And then people go, wait, it wasn't in the movie.
You know, that reminds me, and I only knew this because I was so enamored of the Red Band trailer of Superbad. But it's the very beginning, and they're in the car, and he goes, I am so jealous you got to suck on your mom's tits when you were a baby. And Michael Cera goes, at least you got to suck on your dad's dick. And they cut it right there in the movie. But in the trailer, Jonah Hill goes, he kind of shrugs. He goes, it's a nice looking dick. And then it cuts. And I go, God damn, that's even funnier.
Yep, yep. Oh,
like,
my God.
That's a very improv sort of thing, like a yes and kind of sensibility, which is
totally awesome.
Totally.
And the thing about cutting comedy is there's the editor, stuff the editor struggles with, like, do I find this funny? Is the timing correct? But here's the problem. It goes through 20 people.
Yeah.
And everyone has their opinion of what's funny. And by the time, well, you've got that to deal with, right? You've got 20 people who all have different ideas of what's funny because it's so subjective.
Right.
But then you look at a joke 10 times, stops being funny.
Oh, yeah.
No matter how funny it is. So then you're like, now you've got a problem because nothing's funny anymore. So
do you get fresh eyes on it?
You need someone to come in and be like, that's really funny. That's really funny.
Yeah.
But then at that point, yeah. And so the challenge is getting it out before you reach that point where everyone's sick of the stupid jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where you're like,
they were funny.
Yeah. Now I've heard stupid. This joke a million times.
Yeah.
Now, though.
It's not funny.
Oh, it's so funny.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, drama, like you see an intense scene, it's always going to be intense.
That's true.
If it's really good.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
If David Fincher made it.
We need to wrap up amazingly, which
this
sucks.
This is so much fun.
Yeah, because I think we may have to do it again at some point.
That's good.
And it'll be even looser.
Cool.
But is there anything you want to plug? This is the time in the show where you can plug anything you want. And or is there anything you can plug? We haven't even said the name of your agency, but if you want to keep it that way, we can.
Well, no, my agency is Group 11 in LA, and Group 11 Advertising.
Nice.
Yeah, and Man, I don't have anything to plug, but it's just been so much fun to talk about this stuff. I don't get to talk about it. Editors typically don't get to discuss their craft very much.
So. That's what we do on the show, though.
I love
it. You find people who make the things that we see, but don't think about who's behind it.
Yeah.
And so it's awesome.
It's been awesome. It's been really fun to kind of reminisce and explore and kind of think about this stuff because you don't.
Yeah. You know? Very rarely do you have time. Or sort of the narcissism required to like think about yourself in that level
totally.
Of detail.
Yeah, I feel terribly like self-indulgent right now, but it's kind of fun to kind of think about all this stuff and talk about it with someone who you know is interested in film too.
Totally.
It's really fun.
And you're giving people a chance to sort of peer through the keyhole.
That's cool.
Which is awesome. So
hopefully
anyway,
that's interesting.
Thanks, Matthew. This was enormous fun and much success to you.
Thank you.
And we're going to call that a wrap on episode 73 of the John of All Trades podcast. Big thanks to Matthew Jones from Group 11 Advertising for sharing what he does with us. Something that we all see and we don't think about. He's the guy making it happen. He is one of many. They seem to have a great team at Group 11. If you go look at their work at g11advertising.com, you'll see just awesome, awesome work. Films that you know and love. And so big shout out to them. Thanks to Matthew for coming on the show. Also, a shout to our sponsor, 4Degrees, #4DEGRE.ES. Speaking of marketing, speaking of advertising, this firm will get your message out to the people who need to hear it most. That's right. We're talking viral content. We're talking online grassroots coalition building. We're talking social media marketing. 4Degrees is the best at what they do, and I encourage you to check them out. Go to 4Degrees, #4DEGRE.ES. Proud sponsor of the John of All Trades podcast. We love them. Thank you very much. This is a production of Deft Communications. Check us out on the web, DEFTCOM.US. And then while you're at it, like John of All Trades on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. The way you can do that, pretty easy, JOATpod for both. New episodes are teased on Monday, and then we launch on Wednesdays. That's when you can expect new episodes come to your inbox, whether you're listening on iTunes, whether you're listening on Stitcher, or whether you're listening at the John of All Trades homepage. Until next Monday, when we tease next week's episode, say goodnight, Tracy.